Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I am Pamela Spoto, poet and host.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue, on my tongue.
We are broadcasting from KKRN Community Radio in Round Mountain. We will host a bi-monthly poetry show the last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. So here we go, Late Night Poetry Jam. And I would very much like to welcome Patricia Boone to Late Night Poetry Jam. And this is a phone interview. Patricia is in Chicago, and we are so lucky to have her. So hello, Patricia.
Well, hello, everyone out there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very honored.
I met you, Patricia, when you were in Reading at Shasta College, and then And I remember you were sitting in class, and we would be having these wonderful discussions, and you were very articulate. You wrote poetry. You also drew artistically. And I was thinking, what a creative person Patricia is. And then I had the opportunity to listen to some of your presentations about your life. And then didn't you get a full ride scholarship to go to UC Berkeley?
I did. It's called the Jack Kent Cook Foundation Scholarship, and it's the largest scholarship that's awarded to Canadian college students. Very competitive, but again, they cover up to $30,000 for each year of acquiring your bachelor's degree. So,
and I thought
it was pretty big.
That was enormous. And then, how long were you at Berkeley, and what did you study?
So after I left Shasta College, I went to Berkeley. I was there for 2 years. I could have done the 3-year path, but instead I just decided I really wanted to get to law school. Being an older student, I was just really driven to get there. So I did 2 years, and when I first went to UC Berkeley, I thought, okay, the most logical step for me was to potentially get into, like, the media studies communications major. So what I ended up doing was finding that they had what is called an American Studies major, where you can choose your areas of concentration, pick your fields of study, and actually propose an original research project. And that's what I did. I did an honors thesis. So while I was at UC Berkeley, under the umbrella of American Studies, I focused on three areas of concentration, and that was race, law, and juvenile delinquency and how they intersect. What I discovered after taking classes in public policy, legal studies, sociology, and so forth, was that there was a silence that existed, and that was particularly when it came to female delinquency. So being that I was located in Berkeley, I spent a lot of time in Oakland. I would drive often through, you know, down International Boulevard for various reasons. And so part of me was really interested in kind of the plight of black females and girls in street prostitution and how they were kind of left out of both the delinquency conversation in addition to the expanding umbrella of human trafficking altogether. And so basically my honors thesis looked at how the way we view the value of the victim or the perpetrator in terms of policing basically street prostitution that heavily impacts minorities was very much related to chattel slavery.
Yes, and I do want to say for our audience that, you know, one of the reasons I enjoy being in conversation with our guests is that it's my contention that writing doesn't happen in a vacuum. And for example, some of the issues that I'm really concerned with have to do with environment and politics and justice and love. And so I'm very aware of that. I'm reading about that. I'm talking to people about those things, and I write about those things. And so it would appear, and from what I know of you too, that your interests, as you had just mentioned, in terms of your honors thesis, of race, law, justice, juvenile delinquency, those people without a voice, policing minority groups. And so all of these things kind of culminate and come together into to what you are interested in, what you have a passion about, and what you write about. Would you say that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I think what you're hitting on that I am, I guess, beginning to really understand is kind of my core value or my, you know, core passions, is that when you don't have a voice and you can't speak up for yourself and remain in the conversation, you almost feel like you're not recognized as human.
Yes.
And so a lot of my interest is in restoring the humanity, right? Getting other people to recognize that no matter kind of where we've come from or what our life circumstances are, is that we have just as much of a stake in the conversation. And that becomes with being able to first recognize that we are a part of this society. And so when I did my honors thesis, a lot of it was about the cognitive dissonance that surrounded the neighborhood in terms of, you know, that you could drive down International Boulevard at 1 p.m. and there would be a 14 or 15-year-old girl, working girl on the streets, and then there would be a grammar school getting out, and mothers would go and pick up their children. And so a part of me was really curious how all of those various things interacted, you know, and how people could kind of, you know, look past and look over kind of the situation that a lot of our young girls were facing.
Yes. And so then after UC Berkeley, you decided to go to Northwestern Law School. Is that correct? And how long have you been in Chicago?
So, yes, that's correct. I am now a lovely 2L, which is a second year at Northwestern University Law School. I've been in Chicago a little over a year, and I'm very much headed back to California because I went through the most brutal Midwest winter that definitely made me a California lover even more.
But you know, we're having a drought out here.
I know. It was raining here yesterday. I thought with all of our scientific advancement, they still haven't figured a way to take like our oversaturated situation here and somehow transfer that to California.
True. And I also wanted to tell our listeners that that Patricia is of mixed race heritage, and she's black and white. And I think this adds another really interesting component to the dynamic of her writing and her interests and her research. And you mentioned to me that you are doing, is this correct, more reflection and some reflective writing since you've been in Chicago. And could you talk about that a little bit? And maybe you could share something that you have written with us about that.
Sure. You know, one of the things in coming out of Chicago was, you know, I was really cut off from any of the support systems that I had built over time, which is really essential to success.
Yes.
And when you're cut off from support systems and you're having to recreate it, you have to kind of fall back on what it is that you know. And what it is that I know is to sit quietly with myself. But once I started to sit quietly with myself, I started to see all the holes that existed. And through that, what I started to do was really take the last year at making it a point to start putting myself back together again so that before I go out and do the important work that I plan to do, that I'm walking into it whole. And so a lot of my work has been focused on really pointing out that the things that make me vulnerable and make me uncomfortable, and just being able to be with that no matter whatever it is.
Yes.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you have a piece of writing that you have been working on or that you have done that you could share with us?
Sure. A piece that I have, so let me just preface this by saying that I'm not, you know, your standard poet or your standard writer. I am more or less, when something comes to mind, some interesting observation within myself or extraneous factors, I just write. And I write on the napkin, I write on whatever is there, and that's just kind of how it goes for me. So this one here, actually, I did, it looks like in June, and I call it Osmosis. So here it goes. Night begins to quiet the soul, but the mind is just getting started. Dark contours and hazy reflections highlight her face as fading stars flicker in her iris. The setting sun promises to return by morning, but not before taking the day's warmth hostage. With bare arms and legs, her tightly wound body hardly gives to the gentle wind. The weight of her world neatly tucked behind her head, guaranteeing an internal headache, a quasi-pillow stuffed with dread, while anxiety's gifts of the unknown lay at her tired feet, providing false hopes of security and control, and self-perception of self-deception of well-earned defeat. There, under the sliver of the moon, lay a disappearing woman. Hidden in the overbearing tall grass of doubt and fear is her waning self-confidence, sinking into the earth and soil, deeper within every spill of her tears. Her spirit broken, her body battered, her mind on repeat. Vulnerable and exposed, dark and cold, her soul faces the envy of night and before the rising light commits the ultimate sacrifice. Reverse osmosis. She sheds the ego, casts out the victim, owns every mental and physical scar, steps into the light, holding hands with darkness, knowing that she, no longer a prisoner of mind, no longer an enemy of darkness, no longer a self-hate generator, but a valuable resource, and within her exists the answer to a once unquenchable thirst. She is salty no more.
Thank you. That is really, really nice. I like the images of that, and the transformation that happens through the poem, and what you had said, and I think this this is true for me too, that you write when you are so moved, and it could be on a napkin, it could be on a piece of paper, it could be wherever you happen to be, and this is also giving. I mean, writing can give voice, and we were talking right about not having voice, and it is a way to put things down, to give voice to those things that are unspoken. And what I really like about that is that, in terms of the poem, that there's a lot of anxiety at the beginning and trying to quiet the soul and feeling vulnerable. But then something happens, something snaps, and then all of a sudden the strength comes out. And that's really beautiful.
Thank you. I find that that's much more like a reflection of reality, you know? I mean, that for me happens, every week. And what I mean by that is, once I came out here, I didn't think that I suffered from anxiety or even depression,
mm-hmm.
because I was always going nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
And once I came out here, I started to find myself faced with that. And a lot of that is like when I get into those real, depths of despair, it is that strength that we all have where we have to like force ourselves to come up and face the day. And I'm not exactly sure what that is, but it's something I think that we all do a lot more often, but we often don't celebrate that part of ourselves.
Yes.
And that's the strength. And yeah.
Yes, and I would like to remind the listeners that this is KKRN Community Radio out of Round Mountain, 88.5 on your radio dial. I am Pamela Spoto, host of the show, and I'm talking with Patricia Boone, who is in Chicago. And this is Late Night Poetry Jam, and we're having lots of conversation, and this is great. And Patricia just shared a poem with us. I want to ask you, working with others, in the past as you were in Oakland, but also in the future in terms of, and maybe this is not exactly correct, but restorative justice, do you see writing having a place in that? I mean, listening to your poetry and knowing, writing helps me get my emotions out on the page, and I can be really angry about something that happens, and I kind of feel powerless, or I do feel powerless when I think of Michael Brown, when I think about Amadou Diallo, when I think about various, injustices in the world, and if I can write about it, I feel a little better. So do you see writing as an integral part of what you do and what you may do in the future?
Absolutely, but I also think that it's one half of the part. And what I mean by that is that I think it's in the act of sharing it that is what makes it truly powerful. Because it's what allows me to turn things that I was once shameful of into something that's like a powerful lesson that could be shared with others. And I have, working with, I just this summer taught a creative writing, which is, I really thought about your class.
Oh, you did? You taught creative writing?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well, I did a creative writing / debate class for 60 youth on the south side of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And a part of it was a mixed bag where we did something called a poetry slam debate, in which they had to use an emotion but without using the word, and the other team had to guess it. And some of the emotions were anger, compassion, sensitivity. Watching these students get really creative, choosing the way not only to read the words but how they conveyed the message. I think that's the power in writing. It's taking it that one more step where you're actually putting it all together with who you are, your body language, feeling the emotion, letting it go, and then watching it be well received.
That's a wonderful process, Patricia. That's a really good description and details of doing that. That's great. I would like to ask you another question here, and maybe you could elaborate, and then we could hear another piece of writing, is that at Northwestern Law School, you are studying law, you're planning on becoming a lawyer, but you also, it's not a but, and you want to work with, did you say restorative justice kinds of issues?
It's like a really interesting process, because when I first arrived at law school, I was very determined at what kind of a lawyer I wanted to be, or very set on, shall I say. And this summer I was able to work within the juvenile court. And what I came away with is that the system itself, it's very static, and there's a lot that needs to change in order for the system to have significant change. So instead of me thinking about how can I work change within the system that will potentially affect one or two people, I'm coming at it from an outside perspective in terms of how can I create programs that will take people that have either been involved in the system or potentially will become participants in the system, and create some kind of alternative. So I guess you could call it restorative justice, except for I think that term is so often overly used. I'm more or less trying to think of it in terms of creating opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Turning on a switch, showing people that the skills that they already possess, where in one aspect gets them into trouble with the law, is something that would potentially be beneficial if used in a different way. So I'm not looking to create new people per se.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking to take the people that already exist and just show them new ways in which to become, who it is that they want to be. So through education, through alternative sentencing programs, things of that nature.
I see. And that is very good and necessary work. And before I talk about, or we talk about, policing and the justice system a little bit more, is there another piece of writing that you could share with us?
Sure.
Good.
So this is one that I think that sometimes I write, and I write in terms of what is going on within my life. And it can be even really simple stuff, from commuting
yes,
or just simply from getting grades. And so this piece that I'm about to write is actually something that came out of my law school experience, meaning that your first semester grades aren't released until you're 3 weeks into the new semester.
Oh.
And grades are very, very stressed in law school, kind of that if you don't have a certain GPA, it's basically this fear that you're not going to get a job and you're not good enough and you're not going to succeed. And so it becomes a very, very physically heavy environment around the law school. And I don't think that's unique to Northwestern. I think that's the way that the law schools are set up.
Yes.
So this one was something that I shared actually on Facebook so that some of my other colleagues might be able to, might have a chance to read. So this one is, do you know your measurements? Whether you've checked your grades lately or were dissatisfied, disappointed your boss to a point of embarrassment, or received yet another rejection letter, don't internalize these messages as evidence of failure. Instead, pause for a moment, recognize the beauty in your efforts, appreciate your courage to take a risk, and celebrate your tenacious spirit. You stuck it out till the end. It's easy to get caught up in first-world ideologies of success. It's second nature to associate temporary disappointment with long-term loss. It's common to assess your abilities in relation to your counterparts, but it's harder, much harder, to show yourself grace. If you are measuring yourself according to a set of numbers, what will you do when those numbers disappear? If you are holding yourself to a standard of perfection, what will happen when you have a less than perfect day? If you are striving to meet a generally accepted standard of success, how will you respond when you are generally rejected? If you don't define your measurements now, you stand to lose the best parts that look good on you later. Just maybe it's time to become a better seamstress, tailor in your life. Take out your tools and replicate your perfect measurements. Allow extra room for all the wonderful things that led you to this point. Incorporate your imperfections and dreams, and don't forget to sew in a pocket room enough for grace. Grace will get you through disappointing attempts that are certain to come. With every stitch, hold tighter to your vision, for you are making a one-of-a-kind suit, a successful pattern in a life that only fits you. If no one today has told you, you are one successful human being.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. You know, the sense that I'm getting from the two pieces that you've shared is that you really are encouraging. You're encouraging either it's another person or yourself to find the strength, to focus, to keep going, that you're really good, you're a good person, and it's just loaded with encouragement. And I think that that is, that's a really good thing.
Well, I think it's definitely, it's coming from, you know, how do we reverse the belief system, you know? So all of those negative, you know, self-defeating thoughts that come up in a fall, you know, how do we combat that? And I think it's with flooding a new message within. And so when I find myself writing for others, I'm writing for myself, you know? And it really is something that has, I think, has served to really connect me and connect me with others as well, because when I get responses based on some of my writing, and it seems like just the right person hears the right message, and then I know for me to share vulnerabilities, it's really important. It's really critical, both for my survival and for others as well.
You know, that is an interesting word, vulnerability, because in writing and in poetry, and I think about this myself, you know, I think about the audience that I'm reading to. You know, I may share certain things if I'm reading to a class at Shasta College, and I share different things if I'm reading off campus to a different kind of audience, because there is that vulnerability, and how much do we want the outside to see, you know, the inside? And so and I think this notion of vulnerability, especially in our culture, and I'm just kind of going off on a tangent here, is that whether it's the police, whether it's the man, whether it's the writer, that sometimes it's like vulnerability is a weakness, when it's just the opposite. To be able to be vulnerable, I can find strength. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure, because that's still a word that gives me the shivers, you know, even when I say it myself. I mean, it's easy to be vulnerable after the fact, right? In that moment, when I was feeling vulnerable, I was writing by myself, you know, in a space where nobody could see my vulnerability. So I still struggle with it. In fact, I can give a real life example where just the other day, I'm in a few classes that particularly speak to certain topics that I have life experience with in the criminal justice system and so forth. And my professors were asking why we all got involved in juvenile justice work. And so it was going around the room, and, you know, all of my colleagues were saying how they had, you know, either encountered juvenile justice while reading an article, or maybe they had a past employment opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, like, as it was getting closer to me, saying, okay, do you tell the truth? Or do you gloss over it? Like, I was going through this internal struggle because it was, do I expose myself? You know, and once I expose myself, what will happen? And so when it got to me, I said, this is an opportunity for me to share and just for me to be okay with, you know, how I've been affected and connected and why I want to do the work that I do. But it still was very hard for me. And when I feel vulnerable, or when I struggle to feel vulnerable, I realize what it is that it's not the vulnerability that I'm scared of, but it's really that it's coming from a place of feeling unworthy. And it's the possibility that I'm going to expose my true self, and my true self will be rejected, and that rejection is actually abandonment. And that's the thing that drives, that has driven me all these years. And so now I'm starting to look at it as a place of, you know, okay, these people aren't going to abandon me, right? Like, that's not what's really happening here, but that's the lens that I'm bringing to it. And so for me to say, hey, you abandonment, you know, fear of rejection thought, like, the way that I combat that is by continuing to open myself up and getting those kind of that feedback where it's like, oh, wow, you know, your vulnerability gave me permission to feel my vulnerability. And I think that's the process of where I am. But it's an everyday occurrence, and it's still a struggle for me.
Patricia, you are a very wise woman. As I was listening, as I was listening to you, I was thinking about how much self-reflection and analysis that you had to do to uncover layer by layer the abandonment that kind of lies at the bottom. You know, feeling unworthy, exposing true self. Will I still be accepted? You know, the vulnerability of being left and so forth. And so I find that remarkable. And I think for our audience, if it's okay with you, when you were in Reading, I heard parts of your story. Would you, and this goes back to, I believe that who we are today is based on all those experiences and things that we have lived up to this point. And your interest in law school, your interest in justice, your interest in helping juveniles, on one level, it would seem to me that it also stems from the experiences you had as a child and as a young adult. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your story? I remember that you had said, you know, that you had ended up in a group home, foster care, on the streets, and so forth. Could you tell us a little bit?
Sure. And I would just like to say that I absolutely believe, well, I know I wouldn't be in law school had it not been for my childhood experiences.
Yes.
Okay, so basically, I was a ward of the court, which meant, or ward of the state, which I was a former foster youth for 18 years of my life. And I grew up in Los Angeles, California. Now, my story is interesting in a couple of ways in which I just recently discovered, and that is that my mother was also a ward of the court. So, you know, it was almost like I inherited my status.
Yes, yes.
And her kind of untreated trauma that she just dealt with it the best way that she could, which so many people do. When they're hurting, they turn to things to numb themselves. And so her untreated trauma and addiction and so forth, and, you know, worth and abandonment issues, you know, she started to recreate that, and hence I was born into that same environment.
Yes.
So really the point where my life had changed was when I was 5 years old and my brother, Stephen Matthew Boone, was murdered, and he was 4 years old at the time, and I was stood frozen in the other room when it was happening. After that had happened, I bounced from place to place, foster home, group homes, institutions. A few of the institutions that I frequented are no longer in existence because the ACLU has shut them down for various forms of abuse against children. So another thing that's interesting now that I have some education behind me and starting to look at kind of the extraneous factors and kind of what's going on in the political environment is that basically at the time that I was going through the system, basically at about the same time that prisons and jails were starting to get more privatized, well, so were children's institutions. And just similarly to our criminal justice system, as prisons and jails began to be overcrowded, well, so did supposedly emergency homes for children. And so a lot of my growing up, I lived in, you could call them child jails, because they were emergency shelters where you would have a few hundred kids there, but they were locked down facilities. But the difference is that, you know, versus when I was older and got in trouble and went to jail, is that when you're a kid, you're only there because, you know, your parents have failed you, the courts have failed you, or the state has failed you. But you don't know the difference. You know, as a child, you don't understand the difference. You are interpreting it as, I am bad, I am unwanted, I am unloved. And soon that began to be your identity. And so for me, it was a lot of rejection, but at the same time, meeting street smarts. And so by the time I was 14, I started to say that the system wasn't for me, and I became a homeless youth. I started getting into trouble, got caught up with what I now know is sexual exploitation, but back then I didn't understand what it meant. I was a working girl in, at 16 in Las Vegas. And then I finally, you know, I dropped out of high school and just continued to go down that road of kind of self-destruction. But I, of course, I didn't know it was self-destruction. For me, it was just dealing with me, dealing with life, you know, and dealing with life and all the pain meant for me to survive that I needed to almost disassociate myself from it. But what I'm now realizing is that it doesn't matter how much I disassociate myself from the pain, instead it eventually finds its way back. And that is basically kind of my story, where at 25, the pain became so great, the alcohol and the drugs stopped working, and I kept getting into trouble, and I was about to be sent to prison, and there was a judge who basically looked at me and gave me an opportunity to go to school instead of going to prison. And because of this judge, you know, I am now in law school. Because he went against what the prosecutor had asked for, he went against what society would deem would be the right and just thing to do. He even put potentially his career on the line to give me an opportunity. And I've never forgotten what that felt like, because all my life, I had interpreted as I was bad, I wasn't worth anything. And so for me, it made sense that I would just continue down the same path that my mother did. For me, it was, even though I still had the hope and the light within me, you know, it was just a lot easier to succumb to life pressures. But this judge saw something different in me, and he saw something in me that maybe I wasn't able to recognize in myself just yet. And because of his ability to have this vision, I went to Shasta College, and I was in your class, graduated with honors, gave the commencement speech, transferred to UC Berkeley, graduated with honors, you know, now I'm at Northwestern Law School.
Patricia, that is such an amazing story. I love that story. And when you tell parts of it, I just get goosebumps. And I'm going to remind the audience that I'm Pamela Spoda, host of Late Night Poetry Jam. I'm talking with Patricia Boone, who is in Chicago. And we're having a conversation. We're also doing some reading of writing and poetry. And I can see, you know, Patricia, from your story, that I think the first poem that you read here for us had to do with that reflection and with that anxiety, and I can totally relate to that and understand that. And then it transforms into strength and to focus and to dedication, and it really is amazing. I mean, in terms of your life, from going from the abuse of these child jails and working on the streets to graduating with honors from school to school to school. And here you are in Chicago at Northwestern Law School. I mean, that is one awesome, amazing story. And I love it. And so I'm wondering if you have another piece of writing that you could read to us or share with us.
Sure. And before I say that, I think it's always really important for me to say that the reason that I've been able to transform is because throughout my life, even if it was just from one interaction or over a stretch of time, that there have been angels truly along my path. And it's because of certain people. Shasta College was huge. You know, Pamela's photo, you were a big person in my life at that time. Ann Sittig, who was my Spanish teacher, Toby Bodine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a professor at Berkeley who was also very instrumental. And so I always want to give thanks to people like yourselves who also invested in me and showed me that I had a voice worth listening to.
Well,
I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for sharing that, because you also said, and I think that this is really true, having support systems, having connections, having people we can talk to, and even knowing people that can help open doors. I mean, only in the sense that I might not think that the door can open, and yet someone can help me open that door. And so that's a good thing. And what you also said is that when you went to Chicago, I mean, you didn't have that support system yet. And that sounds like something that you have been, you know, you've been reflecting on that, and you have been making connections there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, like right now when I'm mentoring, potentially doing speaking engagements, you know, I really stress that, you know, for people to overcome any type of adversity, it really is a community kind of raising the child mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the importance of being able to connect, because connecting is trusting. And for somebody who has feared trusting relationships all their lives, it becomes a really lonely world. And when you can only depend on yourself, and then yourself turns on you, it can be quite detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
So support systems are those points where, you know, there are people that are reaching for you, and the light doesn't extinguish. And that's why I think that it's so important to also focus on programs that are looking at reentry populations to further say, hey, yeah, sure, you made a bad decision, right? Sure, okay, we have to punish you this amount of time, but we still think you have value. We're still interested in what you have to say and how you will contribute. That's where people really rise to the occasion. And I think right now, in terms of the way we deal with things punitively, we've really stripped that away. And I think that it's at a detrimental to point to our society.
You know,
we're locking away a lot of potential.
That is true, and I was thinking of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I have a book of his, and I think it's a quote from Dostoevsky that he has in there, and he says something like, "Beware of those whose desire to punish is strong." And I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking, why do we as a culture often just want to punish. You know, it's punish, punish, or drop bombs, or put lock people up. I mean, we have more people incarcerated, what, over 2.3 million people in the U.S., more than any other country in the world, kind of like lock up and throw away the key. So that's important to realize that we're all human beings. So do you have a piece that you could read to us?
Sure. This one is called New Routine. Okay, here we go. Some of us did it as children, wrapped in our mother's arms, tucked in by our father's stories. Security, acknowledgement, and acceptance finds us in our sleep, enabling us to wake with self-love and assurance that when the world gets cold, love is all we need. For some of us, security is as tall of a tale as the bedtime stories we crave for. No tuck, maybe no bed at all. Shifting eyes tracing bricks of placement walls, forgetful hands and feet that won't stop running. Insecurity, abandonment, and rejection create a revolving nightmare, placing us in the throes of a dire statistic. Love hurts, but it's the kind we chase. Then there are others stuck in the in-between. Someone rocked us, rooted for us, held our hand, even if it was down a path of self-destruction. We were seen. We were rarely heard. Yet we were acknowledged because we refused to go without. Vulnerability was instability, and resiliency stemmed from capability. No matter how bad it became, we rose, proving to the world we had true grit, but we faced a formidable opponent, our ego-loving selves, ego lovers born from mixed feelings of worthlessness and grandiosity. I say all this. If only there was a store where we could buy it, or an app to download, maybe something a neighborhood store could deliver to our doorstep, or a permanent surgery replacing tapes with old useless belief systems. But alas, there exists no such remedies for restoring our only true gift, a birthright, the elusive and intangible, for some even unimaginable self-love. At 31, I have met my match, called her by a different name, and fell into her trap and set my own. I've refused to look her in the eyes at times, hold her hand when she has fallen, and cast judgment instead of comforting her with grace. I didn't learn how to love her, but now I see that without her, I am self-destructive. Her is me, and I am she, and when we are together, we are one unstoppable force. So self-love is a continuing process, requiring honesty, 50-second chances, and daily appraisals on the softer side. May you always remember that without loving all of you, the good, bad, and the disgusting, wholeness is an impossibility. Have you told yourself lately that I love you? And this is my new habit made possible by my courage to look deep within. To the all of you, the ones who needed to hear this today, may you remember how wonderful you are. So again, there's another kind of encouraging.
Well, it is. It definitely is. And I was taking a few notes as you were reading that, and especially at the end, I think it's difficult, you know, and it's so true, the wholeness that we have to love all of ourselves, you know, and sometimes I think we do want to, well, I know I do, I don't want to think about the bad or something that I've done that I'm ashamed of or something that happened in childhood, but unless I can embrace it all, I'm not accepting myself, and if I don't accept myself, then I have real issues and problems, and I'm not accepting of others as well. And so I think that's a real strong message, you know, in that poem that it's I love that it's our birthright, you know, to love self, and the idea that you brought in apps because I mean I think about you know computers and applications of you know how to do this, how to do that, how to break up with somebody. I mean, it's an app. I mean, my goodness, how many people really take the time to be introspective and reflect, you know, sit down with self, because we're so busy. And I think you mentioned that in the beginning of the show, that when you moved to Chicago and you were so busy, and I know I can be so busy at work that I don't take the time to sit, to listen, to think, to hear what my inner voice, you know, what is going on with myself. And I think that is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're touching on is that's important as well, is that when you stop running, all the things you run from catch up with you.
And that's why people maybe... I'm sorry, but that's probably why people often keep running.
Well, that's definitely why I ran. You know, I ran away from those things. And so when I moved to Chicago and, you know, entered a rigorous academic program that said, hey, during your first year, you can't work. And I went, what do you mean I can't work? I've always worked multiple jobs.
Yes.
Well, no, you're supposed to be doing homework. Well, then I would open up my casebook and it would be, you know, especially my criminal law class, it'd be cases that would be very much, there were a couple of cases of child homicide that would almost have a PTSD kind of triggering effect on me. And all of a sudden, some of the things that I was running from would start catching up with me. But thankfully, and this gets back to the support system, is that, you know, I had so much practice when I was at Shasta College of reaching out for help that I was able to duplicate it when I went to Berkeley. And now I've fine-tuned it now that I'm at law school. So even though the process is still hard and it's still painful, is that it's become more expedient because I know what to do and I can do it at a faster pace.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take me, I don't have to, like, you know, go through, you know, a year or two of depression. You know, now I can pick up the phone where it used to be incredibly heavy for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, but that only comes through practice.
Yes.
You only get better through practice. And healing, unfortunately, that, you know, it's not quick like an app or kind of in our society, which we want these quick fixes. But healing is slow. But why wouldn't it be when you've accumulated so much pain over such a long period of time? Right? The truth is that it's probably going to take me, you know, at least, you know, 31 years to start to kind of excavate my true self to really become whole.
I like that. I like that, to excavate my true self. That could be a title of an article or a poem. I like
I mean, that's basically been, you know, been this past year. But the problem, you know, with excavation is that you might uncover some things that you're not ready to deal with.
That's true. And especially if you're in the midst of a high-powered law school or wherever a person might be, that excavation takes a certain kind of energy and thought process and emotionality that can really interfere sometimes with the work that we need to do at the time. So it's a delicate balance.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the conversations that I had with some of my fellow classmates last year was that, you know, in law school, I don't mean to say just in law school, in a really competitive environment, and this is going back to what we talked about earlier, kind of exposing that vulnerability is seen as a weakness.
Yes.
And even though that might not necessarily be true, it does impact the environment in such a way that people are less likely to be open. Well, when people aren't open and you don't know if someone's struggling, then you don't create that community. And almost everybody's on an island by themselves. So the conversation that I had with a classmate was that I was struggling. And one of my classmates had said, well, is it because of the material, right? No, it wasn't even the material. It was that there were some days I couldn't even get out of bed, let alone read my assignment. So it was, I couldn't even face the day, let alone what I had to do that day.
Mm.
And I think sometimes we gloss over thinking that the rigorousness of life or the daunting task are within themselves the part that's hard. But in fact, sometimes it's just taking a step that's really the hardest thing that we've had to do today. And that has definitely been my experience. So you know, I'm at a point in my life, I think, through this transitional period, where I have a lot more empathy and compassion for people who struggle to take that first step.
Yes. Yes. Patricia, I'm wondering, I would like to talk about the police. And sure. I would also, after we finish doing that, I'd like to hear a few more pieces of your writing. I want to start this discussion. Number one is that you're in law school. Number two, that you are really smart and articulate. Number three, you're a writer. Number four, you come from a mixed heritage. And as we look around, and I've been talking more to classes about this too, as we look around the United States and we see young black men being killed by the police, it's more than heartbreaking. I mean, it's just this tragedy, this terrible situation. And I wanted to kind of start with just take a minute or two. We had an interview with Norm Stamper, and he was a police chief in Seattle. And he's retired now, but he's on the lecture circuit. And he's saying the entire structure of the police, it's not one little fix here or one little fix there or a Band-Aid there or a training class there, that the whole institution of policing has to change. And he also believes that we need to abolish the death penalty, in the war on drugs, you know, work on domestic violence, take the brutality out of the criminal justice system. But he's talking about this culture of police, and I would think he should know, being a retired police chief, that police often work from, and it's a difficult job, but all often work from a place of fear and being afraid. And if they have, especially the white policeman, if through his experiences and what older police officers have told them, there's a fear about especially black men. And he said, and especially if it's a young, a large black man, that the immediate feeling of the police is one of danger. And then from that, all kinds of things can happen. But he's suggesting that the culture of police has to change to one of patience and education and maturity and calmness and a kind of confidence about learning how to communicate with the people, you know, not the militarization, the guns, the tear gas, the shooting, the brutality, that all has to change. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, because we've been having conversations in class about Michael Brown and what happened. And I know not all the information is in, but I do know certain things, like number one, he's an unarmed black man. Number two, his body lay in the street for what, 4 or 5 hours? And just really inconsistencies here. And then the response of people, the community to that. But also then there's this culture of, how do I want to say it, institutional violence, where 53 police officers in this area are white, only 3 are black. And so there are probably, I'm assuming, a lack of understanding, to say the very least, about a culture that you're supposed to be protecting and serving, which doesn't turn out to be that. So could we have a conversation and some thoughts that you think about this, and then we'll go back to your reading some more writing, if that sounds good to you.
Sure. Wow, you know, there's so much.
There's so much, I know.
There's just so much. And I think that really is more reflective of how the American public feels, that it's overwhelming,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
We're dealing with stuff that appears to be new, but really, is it new? Vigilante injustice, you know, fear of black men. You know, these aren't, you know, new inventions of
no.
this era. They're really relics of an old system. So the only difference is that now we have media coverage that can bring it to our attention a lot faster. But it brings me back to hangings and various things like that. So, again, a lot and overwhelming. I think the gentleman, you said his name was Sergeant
His name was Norm Stampler, a former police chief of Seattle.
I think that what he is saying, you know, and of course he's going to be, you know, the authority, you know, to a certain degree on this issue, is absolutely, I mean, there has to be a significant overhaul within the way that police organizations are run. They are very insulated,
yes,
which I think is one of the really big problems, right?
Yes.
And I remember reading an article, I can't remember... I think it was in the New York Times, but I can't remember who the title of it or even who the author is. But it said something to the effect where they had interviewed generals within the military who had even said that even when they are in a war zone, you know, they don't just come out like automatically when they potentially hit with a civilian with their weapons drawn. That this is something that is really unique to our local police enforcement,
mm-hmm.
the way that they deal with issues, which brings me back to, you know, the dogs, you know, turned on people, or the presence of violence, right? It's
yes.
automatically, it's meeting fear with more fear.
Yes.
And that has never worked in the past, and I don't believe that it will ever work. What I think that's more interesting surrounding this issue with Brown, which, by the way, you know, my heart goes out to that community and to his family, but also for the police officer's family, too. I think that's important because there's a lot of lives that are affected by this. But what's really interesting is if you actually look in terms of when this happened, you know, previously before Michael Brown, you had Crawford, the gentleman who was killed in Walmart.
Yes.
Just around the same time.
Yes.
And before that, you had, and I think you mentioned it in a question to me in the email, Mr. Clyde, the
yes.
rancher.
Yes, the white guy.
And, right, you had him. And then you also had the gentleman from the Clippers owner. And, but also, probably the one of the most things that are actually going to be going to be really detrimental in terms of black life, and more so, I think, than the police, is what the Supreme Court has been able to do in terms of dismantling the civil rights
yes,
act one
yes.
by one, from voting to affirmative action and so forth. Now, I'm saying all this to say that there is some kind of, I think that there's some kind of interest in demonstrating this as some new phenomenon that will generate some kind of incentive, whether it's a fear incentive, whether it's, I think Missouri, their gun sales like exponentially increased, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their gun manufacturers, they're probably happy about these kind of circumstances.
Yes.
But I also think it's also one of those things of smoke and mirrors where we have to really sit back and ask ourselves, A, you know, is this new? No, it's not. You know, who are the police? Well, unfortunately, the police, they rose out of vigilante groups. And they've kind of taken on that same sort of kind of mindset, that kind of us versus them mentality. And when they're in the communities and you have certain things like broken window policing, when they also police differently in lower income neighborhoods versus middle class neighborhoods. And then you have the only type of images, kind of propaganda that are put out there are black men or black bodies are less worthy. They have the value of their victim status is almost non-existent because people don't want to see black as a victim. Then you start, and then you flood it with images of, you know, places like, you know, or programs like Lockup and things like that. I think you're essentially in doing the same thing, and that is that I don't think that black was ever really seen as a part of our, you know, United States democratic institution. institution. And no, I don't think that Black had ever had value.
Those questions are really wonderful in terms of giving the audience a lot to think about. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show and for your authenticity, for your work, for your creativity, for your self-analysis, for your reflection. And it's really wonderful talking to you, and thank you. You've been listening to Late Night Poetry Jam. I'm Pamela Spoto. I've been talking to Patricia Boone from Northwestern Law School in Chicago. This is KKRN 88.5. Tune in for our next show, which will be November 29th. Bye-bye.